You're listening to the Swim Out Podcast, a show about the wonderful world of outdoor swimming.
Hello, Hunter.
Hello, Vicky.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of the Swim Out Podcast, where we'll be talking all about the pioneers in our glorious world of open water swimming.
From the myths through to heroes and heroines to superstars banging on the doors of the Hall of Fame.
We talked to an expert on bathing about a man known as the Swimming Professor.
I think he was just an extremely prolific teacher and promoter of swimming as a sport and as a technique.
Then we visit the Belle of the Ball, the first female to swim the channel.
It sounds crazy, I know. But when I swim in the sea, I talk to it. I never feel alone when I'm out there.
Anna reveals all with the history of the Speedo.
So although these women were the first amazing pioneers to compete in the Olympics, unfortunately they were also the pioneers of the wet t-shirt competition.
And the absolutely incredible story of Charles Tuna Chapman.
Black people been waiting too long for this for you to fail, brother. Man, this was my shot now. I was pumped.
Bumper episode coming up today, Hunter. Who's your hero?
My pioneer in the open water swimming community has to be Captain Matthew Webb. He was basically the first guy to swim the English Channel. He had a pretty amazing catchphrase, which went by "Nothing great is easy." You can apply that to pretty much any situation in your life. And he had a really good mustache. I love the guy. I got him tattooed on my arm a couple of weeks ago. I don't know, have you seen it in person yet, Vicky?
I have, yes. You showed it to me at the Lido.
Yeah, thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I do think it does look at maybe a little bit Freddie Mercury-ish.
Oh, yeah, no, you're maybe the second person to say that. But, you know, it's just that luscious, luscious mustache.
I love it because when you go to train in Dover to swim the channel, the statue of him looms over you. And I love thinking about the fact that while he was swimming, he was drinking ale and eating meat pies.
Yeah, it was an incredible approach to nutrition back then, really, like the Wild West. But not only was he, you know, the first guy to swim the English Channel, he kind of became a modern swimming celebrity. But then obviously tragically dies swimming down Niagara Falls in this kind of foolhardy attempt that was destined in a way for failure. But anyway, on with the show we must.
Let's begin with a voyage through time. And what better place to start than with the Greeks in the 5th century BC? It was the golden age of Greek civilization where writing, philosophy and theatre flourished. Democracy was born and the first ever Olympics took place on Mount Olympus.
Yes, although the sea played a big part in Greek culture and mythology, it's the tragic story of Hero and Leander that has captured so many writers' and artists' imaginations.
Hero was a beautiful priestess to the goddess of love, Aphrodite, known as Venus to the Romans, and she met Leander, a handsome youth, at a local festival. They fell in love, but she had sworn a vow of chastity and could never marry. So the two lovers decided to meet in secret. Each night, Leander would swim across the Hellespont, a narrow strait separating Asia and Europe, to be with her. Hera would leave a lamp burning in a window of the tower in which she lived, as a beacon to guide him. One stormy winter's night, the wind blew out the flame, causing Leander to lose his way and drown. When Hero saw his dead body washed up on the rocks, she threw herself from the tower to her death to be with him.
The aquatic love story inspired great writers and poets to retell the story. The first in the English language was by Shakespeare's contemporary Christopher Marlowe. He never finished the poem, and like Leander, faced an untimely death.
Those orient cheeks and lips exceeding his, that leapt into the water for a kiss of his own shadow, and, despising many, died ere he could enjoy the love of any. So lovely fair was Hero, Venus's nun, as nature wept, thinking she was undone, because she took more from her than she left, and of such wondrous beauty her bereft.
The romantic poet and notorious fornicator, Lord Byron, became enthralled with the legend on his first European tour. So in 1810, he followed in Leander's footsteps and, aged 22, swam the 4 mile strait between the Aegean and Black Seas to prove that it was possible.
This morning I swam from Sestos to Abydos. The immediate distance is not above 1 mile, but the current renders it hazardous. So much so that I doubt whether Leander's conjugal powers must not have been exhausted in his passage to paradise.
He inked his experience in a poem recounting the swim.
For me, degenerate modern wretch, though in the genial month of May, my dripping limbs I faintly stretch and think I've done a feat today. But since he crossed the rapid tide, according to the doubtful story, to woo and Lord knows what beside, and swam for love, as I for glory.
Another heroic poem dating back to the 7th century tells the tale of the Scandinavian prince Beowulf and is considered one of the most important works of Old English literature. In this translation by Seamus Heaney, Beowulf brags about his swimming prowess as he pits himself against a childhood friend.
Each of us swam holding a sword, a naked, hard-proofed blade for protection against the whale beasts. Shoulder to shoulder, we struggled on for 5 nights until the long flow and pitch of the waves, the perishing cold, night falling, and the winds from the north drove us apart. The deep boiled up, and its wallowing sent the sea brutes wild. Oh, my armor kept me safe when some ocean creature pulled me to the bottom, pinioned fast and swathed in its grip. I was granted one final chance. My sword plunged, and the ordeal was over.
Back in the real world, there was, of course, lots of swimming going on. It just wasn't recorded.
Oh, I do like to be beside the seaside. I do like to be beside the sea.
But it wasn't until Victorian times that swimming really flourished and the seaside resort was born. One of the pioneers from the 19th century is Fred Beckwith, a dubious world champion and the patriarch of a swimming dynasty.
It's true to say that there's lots of larger-than-life figures in the swimming community, and Beckwith was certainly that. I met up with my friend George Townsend, who's currently working on a PhD about the illustrious bathing history of Oxford, to discuss Victoriana and Beckwith's role within the invention of modern marathon swimming.
In the 18th century, there was a massive kind of bathing craze. Bathing was seen as this healthy thing where you would go to the seaside and rent a little bathing machine and go out into the water and be kind of dipped in the water. And I think that kind of encouraged a culture of swimming. And then partly because of the prevalence of gambling, there grew up this culture of like relatively informal swimming competitions. I mean, a classic thing that Beckwith did, he would turn up at a pub and he would issue challenges and he would basically say, anyone who wants to try and swim against me from, say, Hammersmith to Putney Bridge in the Thames, come and have a go. And over the 19th century, we get a kind of transition from that kind of form of swimming to amateur swimming becomes the big thing. And it's the amateur swimmers who aren't professionals who are organising big galas and kind of issuing qualifications and all this kind of thing. And that has quite an interesting effect. It doesn't completely kill off this more informal side, but in a way it kind of drives it into the world of entertainment.
So at what stage does Fred Beckwith kind of enter the picture? Where's he come from, and how does he eventually earn the dubious title of swimming world champion?
It seems as though he was born in Ramsgate on the Kent coast in 1821. So Beckwith grew up in this world where bathing and swimming were the heart of the town that he lived in. But there was also this growing kind of world of entertainment. So in the early 1840s, Beckwith moves to Lambeth and starts participating in competitions there. The two best swimmers emigrated to Australia, and just following that there was a big competition and Beckwith managed to win. And so he quite jammily took this title of world champion. And he wasn't one to let an opportunity for kind of self-promotion lie. You know, he was referred to as the ex-champion of the world pretty much throughout the rest of his life in newspapers and in posters and memoirs and stuff.
Before we get onto Webb, what is the swimming professor?
Fred Beckwith, who was kind of the preeminent swimming teacher of the age, was known as the professor, like Arsene Wenger, the former Arsenal manager. I mean, in a way, it was a generic term. You had lots of swimming professors. But it was basically, to refer to him as the professor, it was kind of a sort of mark of respect of him as a teacher. I mean, I think he's someone who kind of graduated from competitive swimming to becoming a very well-known coach and sort of entrepreneur, really. He was running various kind of commercial exploits throughout the mid-century.
So, do we know how Captain Matthew Webb and Fred Beckwith may have met, or much about the relationship between the two men?
So we know that they were introduced by a journalist called Robert Watson, and Webb approached Watson with this idea of swimming the English Channel, which I think had been attempted not that long before, but it was a completely failed attempt. And Webb, who had gained a lot of recognition for his sort of heroic swimming feats in the Navy, thought he should have a go doing the Channel. So, but he needed a promoter, and he wanted someone who could train him. So he approached Watson, and Watson thought Beckwith was the man. And initially Beckwith was really dismissive and really not interested in this guy. I think there was a sense that, you know, this person isn't part of the world of competitive swimming, this world of kind of entertainment and racing. You know, he wants to do this really, really long swim, and he wants to do this really, really long swim just on his own, not even against anyone else. He also swims breaststroke, which is really unfashionable. He didn't really cut the dash of the next big thing in racing swimming. So, but anyway, Watson, I think, persuaded Beckwith to come out on the Thames with him and Webb. And Webb did a swim south from the city centre, and his style apparently was so consistent and steady and strong and monotonous that they actually got sick of watching him swim. And at one point Beckwith was like, right, I've seen enough, like, whatever, okay, like, you start Monday kind of thing. And apparently Webb was like, no, let's keep going, I want to go further, and then we'll swim back in with the tide. And Beckwith's like, well, you won't with me. And gets out of the boat, and he's like, you know, come down to Lambeth Baths, we'll see what we can do. Like I kind of alluded to before, endurance swimming, like really long swims, wasn't a thing that people were training for at that time. It was all about speed.
So what do you feel like is Fred Beckwith's kind of pioneering contribution? Was it partly just through his kind of association to Webb, or is there anything more behind it?
The slightly less glamorous answer is that I think he was just an extremely prolific teacher and promoter of swimming as a sport and as a technique. And that was through his own teaching, but also through his children and even his grandchildren, who followed in the family business, mm-hmm. as well as teaching countless people to swim at the Lambeth Baths. He also taught at lots of schools. When he died, aged 77 in 1898, he'd been teaching swimming the day before. Yeah, just yeah. Totally consistent dedication to this art form that he really loved.
Amazing. I'm a massive fan of his daughter, Agnes Beckwith, actually, who I've read about. She was billed as the greatest lady swimmer ever. She did all these fantastic swims in the Thames, kind of leaping off boats and swimming up and down. And what I like as well is that she apparently swam in a stylish little straw hat.
This is the Swim Out Podcast with Vicky and Hunter.
Change was in the air in the early 1900s when women were first allowed to compete in aquatic sports in the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. And a few years later, the Women's Swimming Association was founded in America.
This gave rise to the swimming suffragists, who fought for women's rights in and out of the water, as well as fighting against the heavy full-body bathing costumes. A bit more on that later. Women finally got the vote in America in 1920, and one young woman started making waves at the Paris Olympics in 1924. Gertrude Ederle won a gold and 2 bronze medals.
At the Olympic races, I had to swim like hell. When we're in the water, we're not in this world.
By the age of 20, she had set 29 world records in women's freestyle, including the long-distance swim from New York to New Jersey. She completed the 17.5 miles in just 7 hours and 11 minutes, a record that stood for over 80 years. The swim was then named after her.
To me, the sea is like a person, like a child that I've known a long time. It sounds crazy, I know, but when I swim in the sea, I talk to it. I never feel alone when I'm out there.
Then, in 1926, Gertrude, fondly known as Trudy, made more history.
She had conquered the English Channel. Only 5 men had ever done it before, but Trudy's time was 2 hours faster, and she was a woman. The roaring 20s never were louder, and New York's reception was overwhelming and historic. This was the city's first ticker tape parade.
She revolutionized swimming with her 2-piece bathing suit and was covered in lard and petroleum to cope with the cold water and jellyfish. She wore a pair of motorcycle goggles to protect her eyes from the salty water. She saw off 3 other women swimmers who were all vying to make history, and the swim itself attracted huge media attention and even a band of supporters.
Let me call you, sweetheart.
I bet all the women in the world will celebrate tonight. It's up with the women, down with the men.
The American press dubbed her Queen of the Waves and the grease-smeared Venus. In an interview for the New York Times, she said,
"People said women couldn't swim the channel, but I knew it could be done. It had to be done. And I did it."
Trudy was a trailblazer with celebrity status. President Calvin Coolidge dubbed her America's best girl. She enjoyed a few months of being the most famous person in the world. And she went on to star in a film called Swim Girl and toured vaudeville. They even devoted popular songs to her. Her achievement made a lasting contribution to women's sport during a decade in which gender roles were shifting. Her accomplishments paved the way for other female swimmers. The next 4 people to successfully swim the channel after her were all women.
What a role model. She retired from swimming very young, only age 22, and went on to coach deaf children. She lived to the ripe old age of 98 with 2 female companions.
I love that story of her and the other swimmers who apparently played golf at Cap Grenet in France, waiting to get the slot to swim.
Get in touch with the Swim Out podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
Hello there, this is Anna Pajaisky. I'm a material scientist and writer, and it is my great honour to bring to you this little piece on the history and material science of British swimwear. Now, this is a story which is full of amazing pioneers. So, here we go. In prehistory, basically nobody really wore anything for swimming, right? They chunky dunked and they skinny dipped, and they were totally fine not wearing anything at all. By the time we got to the Roman period, there is archaeological evidence of a sort of bikini-like getup, a small top and small bottoms. And as we know, the Romans loved bathing, they loved swimming, and they really believed in the power of water. Now, after the Roman period, of course, we plunged into the Dark Ages. And actually, there isn't really any evidence of swimming costumes at all until the 1700s. Now, by this time, things had got a little bit different. In the 1700s, people had to wear bathing gowns. These were long trousers under a long skirt with long sleeves and a collar all the way up to the neck. Now, these materials were really heavy. They were made of wool and sort of cotton flannel-like materials. And so it's no wonder, really, that swimming in the 1700s didn't really catch on. In fact, I feel like they couldn't really have made it much less appealing to swim if they'd have actually sewn lead weights into the swimming costumes themselves. which is exactly what happened in the following century. So the Victorians were big believers in the health benefits of cold water swimming. People flocked to the beaches in England, and here the beaches were gender segregated, you know, lest an accidental nip slip bring down the monarchy. These bathing dresses, again, were long skirts, long trousers, long sleeves, but they were made of slightly lighter materials like linen or cotton. But because of this, they had lead weights sewn into them. Now, as I was researching for this, I read that the lead weights were there to stop them from floating up. But I wasn't sure if they were referring to the skirts that the women were wearing or the corpses of the women from drowning after having waded into the sea wearing a lead swimming costume. Now, everything changed with an amazing pioneering swimmer whose name was Annette Kellerman. She was an Australian competitive swimmer who developed the short-sleeved, short-short swimming costume, the all-in-one piece which we're rather familiar with today. Annette Kellerman was actually arrested for indecent exposure in the UK and in America, but her costume did eventually catch on in the world of competitive swimming. Now, unfortunately, because they were going for lighter materials to reduce drag, they made these costumes out of silk. So although these women were the first amazing pioneers to compete in the Olympics, unfortunately they were also the pioneers of the wet t-shirt competition because these silk costumes were rather see-through. During the war, rationing of the materials such as cotton, silk and nylon meant that there weren't as many materials available for making civilian items like swimming costumes. Now, funnily enough, the US War Production Board actually issued a regulation which mandated that women's swimwear must be made with 10% less material in order to donate the rest to the war effort. This was the birth of the modern bikini, and it was named after Bikini Atoll. This was the site of several nuclear weapons tests, and it was named such because, and I quote, of the explosive effect on the viewer of such swimming costumes. The final part of this story is the 2000 Sydney Olympics. This was when the Speedo fast skin really made a splash. In fact, 83% of all medals in the 2000 Olympics were achieved by wearing this swimming costume. Now, this costume was made by material scientists who had examined the skin of sharks under an electron microscope. What they found was that the skin of a shark has got all of these little ridges on it, which are called denticles, and these ridges actually cause an area of turbulence as the water flows over. Now that sounds bad, but the effect is that it actually reduces drag in the water. And the swimming costume material scientist mimicked this effect by using a knitted construction which had a similar structure of those little denticles in the V shapes of the knitted costumes. These swimming costumes were subsequently banned from the Olympics because they were deemed to be too performance enhancing. So you heard it here first, people. Material science is better than drugs.
Denticles. Who knew it?
You know, Hunter, due to the scrapping of all the world records after the fast skin fiasco, me and my team were actually the proud holders of a world record for the women's 200-metre freestyle relay. For all of about a day. That was the 2010 Gay Games in Cologne, which was a lot of fun.
The last story we want to share with you comes from across the pond. I first heard about Charles Chapman purely by chance. One evening I came across a video on YouTube. I think it had only been viewed a couple of hundred times and was posted all the way back in 2011. The man talking into the camcorder was Charles, aka The Tuna Chapman, an African-American who single-handedly set about destroying racial stereotypes in swimming.
In the video, he's dressed in a white roll neck and suede jacket, with the unmistakable muscular shoulders and powerful neck of a channel swimmer. He's so much more than an athlete, though. His story is incredible.
A few months ago, I reached out to Najee Ali, the person who interviewed Charlie in the video, because I wanted to find out more about what happened to the real Charlie after the swim. Najee joined me down the line from his home in San Francisco and began by setting the scene in America, telling me about the rife inequality and his own chilling experience of racism in the water.
I grew up in San Diego, California, and I've always loved the ocean. I've been obsessed with it since I was a kid. Now, that being said, I did not know how to swim as a child. I wanted to, but there wasn't much access back in the early 70s. But as luck would have it, when I was 13 years old, I got a job working with a marine biologist. And one day he said that we were going to go out 20 miles offshore to catch albacore. And so they had caught a couple of tuna. They put them in these specially designed tanks that they had built. After that was concluded, one of the crew members said, well, I'm going to go for a swim. And he jumped off the side of the boat. And I ran over to the side of the railing. I was watching him do freestyle. I was watching him do a little bit of breaststroke and backstroke. And after about 20 minutes, he gets back on the boat and he's toweling off. And I, as a 13-year-old, cautiously approached him and says, wow, that was really cool. I'm wondering if you could teach me that. And the guy looked at me and he puts his arm around me and just laughs. And he says, ah, kid, black people don't swim. And everybody on the boat laughed. And I kind of walked off just embarrassed. And I didn't bring it up literally for 30 years. I didn't bring it up to anybody that I wanted to learn how to swim.
Would you be reminded by that comment that was made to you? You know, was it something that was always at the back of your mind?
Yeah, it was always there because it built up on the fallacy that blacks don't swim. You know, we have our too much bone density, too much muscle, all this nonsense. And from literally 1440 till 1880, worldwide, blacks were considered the best swimmers, the best divers, and the best canoe builders. There was no disputing this by anyone. And Europeans were the ones who were writing these accounts of what they could do.
At what stage did you hear about Charlie Chapman?
I started Googling, like, blacks who swim. I didn't come up with a lot of stuff. And then one day, as luck would have it, I spoke with some people with this organization called Diversity in Aquatics, and they had mentioned this guy named Charles Chapman, who lived in Buffalo, New York, and who had swum the English Channel. I said, I think I vaguely remember that name. And they said, yeah, well, you know, he likes open water swimming. Maybe you two can, you know, chat. And so someone tracked down his number, and they gave it to me. And I called him, called me right back, and we just had this instant connection with each other. We would talk regularly at least 2 to 3 times a week. And then at one point he says, hey, I'm going to be coming out to California. You know, let's meet up. I says, I'll do you one better. Why don't you just stay with me? Hunter, I'm not easily starstruck. If a movie star came walking down the street right now, I could care less. For me, it was just like, you know, a dream come true. And he was so accessible and so warm and inviting and just a really gregarious and wonderful person to get to know. He's been such a huge part of my life, especially a part of my swim life. I consider him my dad. There's a photo that I have of he and I, just our arms around each other as good pals. And it's one of my favorite photos. You know, I look at that and I say, yeah. I says, that's something that I'll always keep.
He's one of the most incredible raconteurs I've ever heard in my life. And that's not hyperbole. Every moment has been kind of crystallized in his memory. And why did you decide to interview him?
You know, it's just something that I felt was wise for us to do, to record his story. I didn't know if anybody had really decided to sit down and let him tell it from his perspective. And he says, yeah, let's do that. And so we just started making that happen. And I just kind of went off the cuff and says, tell me about how you got started. And he was talking about, you know, like they wouldn't pass me the basketball and all the rest of these. And it was just so funny and engaging to listen to him and his stories that I just... all right, let's just keep going, you know? And we were there for like 3 or 4 hours just talking, having a conversation.
On WKBW. Okay, here it is, direct from Action Central, the weather for Buffalo and vicinity. Colder with snow flurries or brief snow squalls.
I basically got started in swimming because they wouldn't pass me the basketball.
Well, now it takes more than a robin.
I remember swimming probably at the age of 5. And I progressed along.
And baby, you've got what it takes.
But one day I saw these guys on the nationally televised swim meet. And I got so excited when I saw those guys flying through the water.
The start of the 200 meter freestyle event in the 3-day National AAU Outdoor Swimming Championships at Chicago.
I had a coach in the neighborhood, his name was Bill Manuel. But he'd pick us up at 4:30 in the morning, man, to go swimming. And, you know, he would take us to the Delaware YMCA. And, hey, I was doing my thing. I didn't start out as the fastest swimmer a lot of times, but I'm just one that just endured to the end. It isn't how fast you progress, it's about he that endures. I was just determined. Then my sister invited me out to Los Angeles, California. And I'm swimming with this swim team, you know, I'm doing all right. One day, I meet another friend of mine, his name is Leslie Newell. So we went to the bookstore. Now the bookstore is a very interesting place. I saw the cover of Mark Spitz on the 50 meter jungle with Mark Spitz and Sherm Javor, the Olympic coach, and he's right down the road in Sacramento, California. And I called him up and told him I wanted to be that guy. He said, come on down, man. Let me see what you look like. I did a couple of laps, but my friend later told me, he said, look at him. He's dying all over the place, you know? I retreated to the outer lane. Now, we trained 5-6 hours a day, rain or shine, and it was brutal. And then in the summertime, we trained twice a day, 7:15 to 12 noon. And then we came back from 3 to 5 in the afternoon. My whole regiment was sleep, eat, and swim. But I got to meet my hero, Mark Spitz. He was there, shook my hand, took me out to the bins, gave me a pair of goggles, and inspired me. And the coach said, I'm the wheel and you're the spokes. You keep training hard and this is where you can be. '80 arrives and the boycott.
President Carter won a major victory today in his bid to boycott the Moscow Olympic Games because of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
All I had was a dream, but with the boycott, that kind of ended. But then I heard all the stuff about black people not being able to swim and all this stuff. That really kind of bothered me because I know I was swimming. I had this friend of mine back in Buffalo that was working for my dad in the store. He said to me, he said, Tuna, you need to swim the English Channel, man. I said, what? He said, you need to swim the English Channel. The first thing I did is I made my resume. The channel preparation is a brutal process. There's nothing pretty about it. First, one has to know that they can endure the cold. My friend Frank Withrow introduced me to the California heavyweight champion. His name is Henry Clark. Frank introduced me, he says he wants to swim the channel. He says, what? The channel, black people don't swim, are you kidding? We did the 3-mile swim down the river and that prepped me. So he was in my corner. So the next move was Alcatraz Island. I made the swim and I was the first black guy to do it. Flashed on the front page of the sports in the Sacramento Bee television and everything. And they came out, I guess they thought I was gonna drown. There was a lot of people just thinking that I just wanted to go to England for a free trip, that I wasn't gonna swim the channel. I had a heartbreaking but a very good experience after I look at it. That was one of the few marathon swims I never completed. It was brutal. Open ocean into the inlet. I just really couldn't get comfortable. So some of the people heard that I didn't make the swim in Atlantic City, so hey, there's no way he's gonna swim the channel if he can't swim around Atlantic City. And this swim business, man, you're gonna have some ups and you're gonna have some downs. But anyway, they gave me a great bon voyage party and me and Henry Clark embarked off for London, England.
We're gonna come back to Charlie's story in just a moment, but I think it's worth just dwelling on his legacy for a second.
He's done so much in the open water community. He's done, he swam around Manhattan Island twice. He was the third person to ever swim around Alcatraz Island, and he did it all with the butterfly stroke for that one. You know, when I mention that name, people just give me blank stares. They don't know who I'm talking about. And I say, you got to know about who he is. He's just been an amazing, amazing swimmer, and he's been around for so long. But people have no idea, and you're right, there is no urgency to get to know who he is.
Well, without further ado, here's what happened next when Charlie arrived in Dover.
I'm thinking I'm going to be the first black guy to swim the channel, and there's another brother there on the beach. I'm going, well, who is he? His name is Mike Johnson from Houston, Texas. But anyway, poor Mike, he couldn't hold his teacup when he came out of the water, so that meant you're not going across. My trainer told him, he said, listen, man, black people been waiting too long for this for you to fail, brother. Man, this was my shot now. We had the best navigator in the game in Ray Dixon and his wife, Corey Dixon. She told me, Charles, you're going to have some good times in the water and you're going to have some bad times in the water. But the main thing is that you got to swim through it all. Then the boats were steaming up. The channel boats, they were steaming up. They had all the food and everything loaded down. Me and my dad and Henry Clark, we said a little prayer on the beach. The photographers came down and they shot me. They take two buckets, right? And they throw the buckets over in the water to slow the engines down. And you swim behind the guide boat. The swim began at 7:50 early in the morning, brother. I was pumped. And we're stroking in the blue of Dover, brother. 5-6 hours out, leg cramp. Start to backstroke for a little bit. Captain says, get out or roll over and take it. But that's when my arm training came into play. I had to drag that leg for the next 6 hours, man. And I mean, we're stroking oil slicks and some jellyfish. We had to do a quarter mile turn to get out of the way of the big tankers that was coming right through. And we're stroking. My dad's on the boat. He's fishing and smoking his pipe. The excitement of the channel and your adrenaline flow, man, is incredible. But you know, when I stopped to see the sunset, I knew it had been a long day. But I kept on stroking, And then it was about 9 o'clock at night. We were just outside the 2 mile buoy. Had to get in before the tide changed. A big ship came by, man. And it made a big wake and it gave me a push in. Pushed me right inside the 2 mile buoy. Henry Clark lowered the dinghy boat down. Overhead lights came on. I knew we were getting close then. The English Channel Observer, he got so excited he jumped in the water. What'd he do that for? But we found him in the dark. They lost me for a minute. The way that you know that you cross the channel is when the top of your feet hit the sand. I literally swam up on the beach in the overhead lights, and it was like a little rainstorm came. No one to greet me, but I took the mandatory 10 steps, and man, you talking about elation. I was just thrilled.
So Naji, you eventually had this encounter with Charlie in 2011. And as I understand it, you talked a bit about planning a new swim in Africa, one that had never been attempted before.
We were going to plan on doing it, and I was going to be his crew chief, but it just never came to pass. Yeah, I'm not sure where he is. And it leaves a big hole in my heart, to be honest with you, Hunter, because we were very close and we would talk regularly. But I know he struggled with his issues with addiction. I don't know if he had relapsed or not. I mean, I struggled with mines when I was a young man. I understand the challenges. I literally don't have any idea. So, of course, your mind can start illuminating all these fantasies. I try not to go there. And I've tried a myriad of ways to figure out how I could be able to reach out to him. But none of the ways that I've tried has been very successful. And that hurts because I want him to know that there are people out there that care about him. You're not the only one who's inquired about him. There's been a number of other people who've contacted me. I would give you his information in a second if I could find him, but I can't. And that really does hurt.
And as far as you know, is there any momentum at the moment to bring Charlie some kind of public recognition for this swim or just for his overall contribution within swimming?
Now, there is a woman. Her name is Dr. Marilyn Morgan Westerner, who's writing a book on African Americans in marathon swimming. It's supposed to be coming out next year. And she and I have been trying to lobby the International Swimming Hall of Fame to to recognize Charles.
He's not recognized?
No.
That's shocking me. Actually, I find that shocking.
Well, it was shocking to me, Hunter, and then I heard that there is this little-known clause in the International Swimming Hall of Fame that says that if you have a conviction, a court conviction, you cannot be allowed to enter the Swimming Hall of Fame.
I just find that mind-boggling. So for someone who really was a pioneer in his own right, what do you think the water represented to Charlie?
He just loved the water. He loved being in it. It was just like a sanctuary. He loved teaching people how to swim. It gave him great, great pride. He would tell me when someone, you know, had that aha moment about a certain thing or an aspect in swimming and when they got it. And he'd get so excited for them. When we swam, you could just see his eyes light up when he got in the water. He was so happy. He felt so comfortable, so safe in that environment. And he says, I could just do this all day long and never get bored.
What an amazing swimmer. We've been talking about starting a campaign to get Tuna into the Marathon Swimming Hall of Fame. So if you want to get involved, email us at swimoutpodcast@gmail.com.
We'd like to thank all our guests and contributors for taking part in this edition of the Swim Out podcast, with special thanks to Naji for letting us use his original recording. He also has an amazing podcast called Crossing the Lane Lines, which is about the rich aquatic history of the Black diaspora. It's really good and really worth checking out. And while we're on the topic of podcasts, do check out our contributor Anna Podaisky's show, which is called Handmade and is all about material science.
Next month, as we plunge into winter, we'll be exploring the positive aspects of swimming on mind and body.
In the meantime, swim out
and swim safely.
Bon voyage.